Certain English translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls will occasionally have this fallen language elsewhere, but such instances are bracketed. They have been supplied by translators, but without any manuscript support. The most recent scholarly work on the Nephilim and the later giant clans is the recent Harvard dissertation by Brian Doak. Despite its many merits, Doak's book on the giants fails with respect to the meaning of Nephilim. Annas's groundbreaking article does not appear in either Doak's dissertation bibliography or that of his book. The article likely appeared after Doak had finished his dissertation work. See the companion website for some discussion of Doak's work. End note. Jewish writers and translators habitually think giants when they use or translate the term. I think there's a reason for that. Explaining my own view of what the term means involves Hebrew morphology, the way words are spelled or formed in Hebrew. Since that discussion gets technical very quickly, I've elected to put those details elsewhere, at least for the most part. But since I don't like to leave questions unanswered, we need to devote some attention to it here. The spelling of the word Nephilim provides a clue to what root word the term is derived from. Nephilim is spelled two different ways in the Hebrew Bible, Nephilim and Nephilim. The difference between them is the Y in the second spelling. Hebrew originally had no vowels. All words were written with consonants only. As time went on, Hebrew scribes started to use some of the consonants to mark long vowel sounds. English does this with the Y consonant. Sometimes it's a vowel. Hebrew does this with its Y letter too, the yod. The takeaway is that the second spelling, Nephilim, tells us that the root behind the term had a long I, Y, in it before the plural ending im was added. That, in turn, helps us determine that the word does not mean those who fall. If that were the case, the word would have been spelled nophelim. A translation of fallen from the verb nafal is also weakened by the Y spelling form. If the word came from the verb nafal, we'd expect a spelling of nephulim for fallen. However, there's another possible defense for the meaning fallen. Instead of coming from the verb nafal, the word might come from a noun that has a long I vowel in the second syllable. This kind of noun is called a katil noun. Although there is no such noun as nafil in the Hebrew Bible, the hypothetical plural form would be nephilim, which is the long spelling we see in Numbers 13:33. This option solves the spelling problem, but it fails to explain everything else. The Mesopotamian context, the Second Temple Jewish recognition of that context, the connection of the term to Anakim giants, and the fact that the Septuagint translators interpreted the word as giants. So where does the spelling Nephilim come from? Is there an answer that would simultaneously explain why the translators were consistently thinking giants? There is indeed. Recall that the Old Testament tells us that Jewish intellectuals were taken to Babylon. During those 70 years, the Jews learned to speak Aramaic. They later brought it back to Judah. This is how Aramaic became the primary language in Judea by the time of Jesus. The point of Genesis 6:1-4 was to express contempt for the divine Mesopotamian Apkalus and their giant offspring. Biblical writers had an easy choice of vocabulary for divine beings, sons of God. Their readers would know that the phrase pointed to divine beings, and other passages in the Torah labeled other divine beings as demons, shadim. But these writers needed a good word to villainize the giant offspring. Fallen ones doesn't telegraph giantism, so that didn't help them make the point. My view is that, to solve this messaging problem, the Jewish scribes adopted an Aramaic noun, nafiela, which means giant. When you import that word and pluralize it for Hebrew, you get nephilim, just what we see in Numbers 13:33. This is the only explanation to the meaning of the word that accounts for all the contexts and all the details. The strategy of Genesis 6. But what does it all mean? Why is Genesis 6, 1-4 in the Bible? What was its theological message? I've already noted that the goal was polemic, a dismissal of Mesopotamian religion, but that's a little vague. Let's explore it. Because the content of Genesis 1-11 has so many deep, specific touchpoints with Mesopotamian literary works, many scholars believe that these chapters either were written during the exile in Babylon or were edited at that time. Note: the issue of the Mesopotamian contexts for so much of Genesis 1-11 naturally relates to the debate over Mosaic authorship of the Torah and what that actually means. The issue is complex. I've read or met hundreds of evangelical scholars over my career. Very few would have any trouble with the notion of the Torah reaching its final form during the exile, whether they embrace Mosaic authorship in whole or in part. End note. The scribes wanted to make it clear that certain religious ideas about the gods and the world were misguided or false. Think about the setting. The Jews, followers of Yahweh, were in Babylon, deported against their will by the greatest empire in their known world. Though captives, prophets like Ezekiel and Jeremiah before him had told the people that their situation was temporary, that the God of Israel remained the real sovereign. He was fully in control and was the true God. They would be set free and Babylon would crumble. For Jewish scribes, their work during the exile was an opportunity to set the record straight for posterity. And that they did. Babylonian intellectuals, mostly the priestly class, presumed that civilization in Mesopotamia before the flood had been handed down by their gods. For that reason, they wanted to connect themselves and their intellectual achievements with knowledge from before the flood. It was their way of claiming that their knowledge and skills were divine and, therefore, superior to those of the nations they had conquered. That, in turn, meant that the gods of those nations were inferior to the gods of Babylon. The Apkallus were the great culture heroes of pre-flood knowledge. They were the divine sages of a glorious bygone era. Babylonian kings claimed to be descended from the Apkallus and other divine figures from before the flood. The collective claim was that glorious Babylonia was the sole possessor of divine knowledge, and that the empire's rule had the approval of the gods. The biblical writers, and later Jews, disagreed. They saw Babylonian knowledge as having demonic origins, in large part because the Apkallus themselves were so intertwined with Mesopotamian demonology. The Babylonian elite taught that the divine knowledge of the Apkallus had survived the flood through a succeeding post-flood generation of Apkallus, giant, quasi-divine offspring fathered by the original pre-flood Apkallus. The biblical writers took what Babylonians thought was proof of their own divine heritage and told a different story. Yes, there were giants, renowned men, both before and after the flood, but those offspring and their knowledge were not of the true God. They were the result of rebellion against Yahweh by lesser divine beings. Genesis 6, 1-4, along with 2 Peter and Jude, portrays Babylon's boast as a horrific transgression and, even worse, the catalyst that spread corruption throughout humankind. Genesis 6, 5 is essentially a summary of the effect of the transgression. It gets little space. It's a restrained account. The later Second Temple Jewish literature goes after it full bore. First Enoch 8 goes on to elaborate how certain watchers corrupted humankind by means of forbidden divine knowledge, practices largely drawn from Babylonian sciences, another clear indication that the intellectual context of the story was known to Second Temple authors. Since the Babylonian Apkallus were considered demonic, it is no mystery why Peter and Jude link the events of Genesis 6, 1-4 to false teachers. While attacking their aberrant knowledge, Peter and Jude evoke the imagery of Genesis 6. False teachers are licentious men who indulge in defiling lusts. Like the divine beings of Genesis 6 who did not keep their own domain, defecting from the loyal Elohim of Yahweh's counsel, false teachers despise authority and blaspheme majestic beings whom angels dare not rebuke. Less obvious is the implication of the incident with respect to the promised seed of Eve. The biblical writers draw attention to Noah's blamelessness. Scripture does not specifically exempt Noah and his family from the sinful cohabitation of Genesis 6, 1-4, but since the event was so heinous, it would be absurd to presume otherwise. Note: the quandary of how anyone, including the giants, had survived the flood led some Jewish writers to speculate that Noah himself had been fathered by a watcher. One Dead Sea Scroll, the Genesis Apocryphon, has Noah's father challenging his wife, the mother of Noah, about whether her pregnancy was the work of one of the watchers. She vehemently denies the charge. See chapter 23 for a discussion of Nephilim after the flood. End note. As concepts like divine sonship began to appear in the Bible with respect to Yahweh's people Israel, the Israelite king, and ultimately the Messiah, the theological messaging became important. Noah is in the line of Christ. At no point could it be claimed that the ultimate seed of Eve, the messianic deliverer, was the son of any Elohim besides Yahweh. Note: infecting the messianic line is never a stated goal of the watchers in any Jewish text. Nevertheless, the theological messaging is the important issue. The Messiah is Yahweh's son. There is no divine rival claim on that heritage. End note. Genesis 6, 1-4 is far from being peripheral in importance. It furthers the theme of conflict between divine rebels, the seed of the Nahash, and humanity that will impede the progress of Eden's restoration. It is one of two passages in the Old Testament that fundamentally frame the history of Israel as a people and a land. The other one is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 14. Divine Allotment. The divine transgressions of Genesis 3 and 6 are part of a theological prelude that frames the rest of the Bible. These two episodes, along with a third we'll cover in this chapter, are core components of the supernatural worldview of ancient Israelites and the Jewish community in which Christianity was born. Taken together, these episodes are a theological morality tale about the futility and danger of trying to recover Eden on any terms other than those God has set. After Eden, God still intended to dwell with humanity, but there would be opposition. Divine beings in service to Yahweh could defect, enemies of Yahweh and his rule, from the human to the divine, to something in between, lurked over the horizon. Heaven and earth were destined to be reunited, but it would be a titanic struggle. In the meantime, any effort to recapture God's original intent, apart from God's own strategy and will for restoring Eden, would end in disaster. There would be no Edenic utopia revived by human beings or other gods. It would be a painful lesson. From the Flood to Babel. There are several features of Genesis 6 that an Israelite would have picked up on that informed his reading of other passages in the Torah. Verse 4 is especially noteworthy. The Nephilim were upon the earth in those days, and afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of humankind, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty warriors that were from ancient times, men of renown. The Nephilim are cast as mighty warriors, Giborim, and men of renown, literally, men of the name, Shem. Note: I am aware that the terms Nephilim and Giborim could be distinguished, and that certain Jewish texts and translations take that route. Viewing the terms as labels for one group is also grammatically and syntactically viable. The option is preferable, and really the only coherent choice given the Mesopotamian context for Genesis 6, 1-4 we've discussed earlier. The Apkalus were both giant in stature and the cultural heroes who transmitted the sacred divine knowledge that resulted in civilization. It makes sense to see the biblical writer, as he created a polemic against them, using both terms for one group. End note. The terms Giborim and Shem appear in several places in the Old Testament story. Immediately after the flood, Nimrod, whose name most likely means rebellion, is called a gibbor. Note. See the companion website for more on Nimrod in Genesis 10. Nimrod has not successfully been identified with a known historical figure from Mesopotamian texts. Other scholars consider the name a wordplay on rebellion and consider the description of him as a gibbor to be a clue to another polemic against Babylon. In other words, Nimrod would not be a historical figure, but a theological swipe at Babylon and her gods, since the name and the word gibbor point back to the Nephilim-Apkalu polemic. The parenthetical comment about Nimrod would be the biblical writer's way of saying that Babylon and her religious knowledge that survived after the flood are evil. Nimrod has also been identified with the constellation Orion, the giant hunter in the sky, the realm of the gods. The connection of Nimrod to the giant Nephilim is the backdrop to several odd Jewish traditions about Abraham, including that his family lineage went back to giants. End note. Nimrod is cast as the progenitor of the civilizations of Assyria and Babylon. Once again, as with Genesis 6, the Mesopotamian context is transparent. Assyria and Babylon are the two civilizations that will later destroy the dream of the earthly kingdom of God in Israel, dismantling, respectively, the northern kingdom, Israel, and southern kingdom, Judah. The language is not coincidental. It links Babylon back to Genesis 6 and its divine transgression. The Nimrod description in Genesis 10, in the so-called Table of Nations, is therefore a theological bridge between the violation of Genesis 6, 1-4, and the next momentous event in the Torah that will frame the entire story of Israel. Note. The language also points forward. After Yahweh divides the nations among the sons of God at Babel and declares Israel his own portion, he calls Abram. The intention is not only to start over with a people through whom God will restart the rule of God on earth. In Genesis 12, 1-3, we learn that Yahweh will make Abram's name, Shem, great. But this is but one aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. Other parts of the covenant description connect a great name to divine protection and blessing. The lemmas used in the covenant language appear in the meeting between Abram and Melchizedek, and in the patriarchal blessing of Judah by Jacob, in which the well-known prophecy of kingship is found. See the companion website for discussion. The Nephilim, called Gibborim, and Men of the Name, are the ancestors of the giant clans encountered by Moses and Joshua centuries later in the struggle to claim the land Yahweh had allotted as the inheritance of his people. See chapters 23 to 25. End note. The Tower of Babel. The famous story of the building of the Tower of Babel is about much more than an ill-fated construction project and language confusion. The episode is at the heart of the Old Testament worldview. It was at Babylon, where people sought to make a name, Shem, for themselves, by building a tower that reached to the heavens, the realm of the gods. The city is once again cast as the source of sinister activity and knowledge. Genesis 11, 1-9 reads, "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and settled there. And they said to each other, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone, and they had tar for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top reaches to the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth.' Then Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower that humankind was building. And Yahweh said, 'Behold, they are one people with one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. So now nothing that they intend to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there, so that they will not understand each other's language.' So Yahweh scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore the name was called Babel, for there Yahweh confused the language of the whole earth, and there Yahweh scattered them over the face of the whole earth." You'll notice right away that there's the same sort of plural exhortation going on in verse 7 as we saw in Genesis 1:26. The verse has Yahweh proclaiming, "Let us go down and confuse their language." As was the case in Genesis 1:26, the plural announcement is followed by the actions of only one being, Yahweh. So Yahweh scattered them. It's at this point that most Bible readers presume there's nothing more to think about. That's because other Old Testament passages that speak of this event tend to be omitted from the discussion. The most important of these is Deuteronomy 32:8-9. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob his allotted heritage. Deuteronomy 32:8-9 describes how Yahweh's dispersal of the nations at Babel resulted in his disinheriting those nations as his people. This is the Old Testament equivalent of Romans 1:18-25, a familiar passage wherein God gave humankind over to their persistent rebellion. The statement in Deuteronomy 32:9 that the Lord's, i.e. Yahweh's, portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage, tips us off that a contrast in affection and ownership is intended. Yahweh, in effect, decided that the people of the world's nations were no longer going to be in relationship to him. He would begin anew. He would enter into covenant relationship with a new people that did not yet exist, Israel. The implications of this decision and this passage are crucial to understanding much of what's in the Old Testament. Most English Bibles do not read, "according to the number of the sons of God," in Deuteronomy 32:8. Rather, they read, "according to the number of the sons of Israel." The difference derives from disagreements between manuscripts of the Old Testament. "Sons of God" is the correct reading, as is now known from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Frankly, you don't need to know all the technical reasons for why the "sons of God" reading in Deuteronomy 32:8-9 is what the verse originally said. You just need to think a bit about the wrong reading. The "sons of Israel." Deuteronomy 32:8-9 arcs back to events at the Tower of Babel, an event that occurred before the call of Abraham, the father of the nation of Israel. This means that the nations of the earth were divided at Babel before Israel even existed as a people. It would make no sense for God to divide up the nations of the earth according to the number of the sons of Israel if there was no Israel. This point is also brought home in another way, namely by the fact that Israel is not listed in the table of nations. The Deuteronomy 32 Worldview. So what happened to the other nations? What does it mean that they were apportioned as an inheritance according to the number of the sons of God? As odd as it sounds, the rest of the nations were placed under the authority of members of Yahweh's divine council. The other nations were assigned to lesser Elohim as a judgment from the Most High, Yahweh. That this interpretation is sound is made clear by an explicit parallel passage, Deuteronomy 4:19-20. There Moses says to the Israelites, "And do this, so that you do not lift your eyes toward heaven, and observe the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of the heaven, and be led astray, and bow down to them and serve them, things that Yahweh your God has allotted to all of the people under all of the heaven. But Yahweh has taken you, and brought you out from the furnace of iron, from Egypt, to be a people of inheritance to him, as it is this day." Deuteronomy 4:19-20 is the other side of God's punitive coin. Whereas in Deuteronomy 32:8-9, God apportioned or handed out the nations to the sons of God, here we are told God allotted the gods to those nations. God decreed, in the wake of Babel, that the other nations he had forsaken would have other gods besides himself to worship. It is as though God was saying, "If you don't want to obey me, I'm not interested in being your God. I'll match you up with some other God." Psalm 82, where we started our divine council discussion, echoes this decision. That psalm has Yahweh judging other Elohim, sons of the Most High, for their corruption in administering the nations. The psalm ends with the psalmist pleading, "Rise up, O God, judge the earth, because you shall inherit all the nations." It might seem that God's response at the Tower of Babel incident was overly severe, but consider the context. The point is not that Yahweh was a glorified building inspector. As we noted in an earlier chapter, gods were perceived to live on mountains. The Tower of Babel is regarded by all scholars as one of Mesopotamia's famous man-made sacred mountains, a ziggurat. Ziggurats were divine abodes, places where Mesopotamians believed heaven and earth intersected. The nature of this structure makes evident the purpose in building it, to bring the divine down to earth. The biblical writer wastes no time in linking this act to the earlier divine transgression of Genesis 6, 1-4. That passage sought to portray the giant quasi-divine Babylonian culture heroes, the Apkallus, who survived the flood as men of renown, or more literally, men of the name, Shem. Those who built the Tower of Babel wanted to do so to make a name, Shem, for themselves. The building of the Tower of Babel meant perpetuating Babylonian religious knowledge and substituting the rule of Babel's gods for rule by Yahweh. Yahweh would have none of it. After the flood, God had commanded humanity once again to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. These words reiterated the original Edenic intention, but instead of obeying and having Yahweh be their God, the people gathered to build the tower. The theological messaging of the story is clear. Humanity had shunned Yahweh and his plan to restore Eden through them, so he would shun them and start again. While the decision was harsh, the other nations are not completely forsaken. Yahweh disinherited the nations, and in the very next chapter of Genesis, he calls Abram out of, you guessed it, Mesopotamia. Again, this is not accidental. Yahweh would take a man from the heart of the rebellion and make a new nation, Israel. But in his covenant with Abram, God said that all the nations of the earth would be blessed through Abram, through his descendants. The covenant language reveals that it was God's intention, right on the heels of his decision to punish the nations, that the Israelites would serve as a conduit for their return to the true God. This is one of the reasons Israel is later called a kingdom of priests, Exodus 19:6. Israel would be in covenant with the God of gods and the Lord of lords. Those disinherited would be in spiritual bondage to the corrupt sons of God. But Israel would be a conduit, a mediator. Yahweh would leave a spiritual breadcrumb trail back to himself. That path would wind through Israel, and ultimately Israel's Messiah. From the fateful decision at Babel onward, the story of the Old Testament is about Israel versus the disinherited nations, and Yahweh versus the corrupt rebel Elohim of those nations. The division of the nations and their allotment under other Elohim is behind the scenes in all sorts of places in biblical history. I'll give you a glimpse of what I mean in the next chapter. Chapter 15. Cosmic Geography. In the last chapter, we got our first exposure to Deuteronomy 32:8-9, Yahweh's disinheritance of the nations. This was the theological lens through which an ancient Israelite viewed her own nation with respect to all others, and her Elohim, Yahweh, against the gods of those nations. By definition, Yahweh was superior. He was Most High, Elyon, the title used in Deuteronomy 32:8-9. Note. Most critical scholars believe Israel's faith evolved from polytheism and contend that Yahweh and Elyon, Most High, are separate deities in Deuteronomy 32:8-9. Though some critical evangelical scholars would file that idea under progressive revelation, I reject the evolutionary idea. End note. The Old Testament, therefore, describes a world where cosmic geographical lines have been drawn. Israel was holy ground because it was Yahweh's inheritance, in the language of Deuteronomy 32:8-9. The territory of other nations belonged to other Elohim, because Yahweh had decreed it. Psalm 82 told us that these lesser Elohim were corrupt. We aren't told how the Elohim Yahweh assigned to the nations became corrupt, only that they were. It is clear from Deuteronomy 4, 19-20, 17:3, 19:25, and 32:17 that these Elohim were illegitimate for Israelite worship. This cosmic geographical perspective explains several odd passages in the Bible and provides dramatic theological backdrop to others. Some of the most startling are in the New Testament. I'll hold those until we reach the time of Jesus and the apostles. For now, I'll illustrate the point with some short but fascinating examples. David's predicament. After his anointing by Samuel and victory over Goliath, David spends a good deal of time trying to escape the blind rage of King Saul. During the time he's on the run, David occasionally must flee into territory outside the borders of Israel. In one of the episodes where David finds Saul in a vulnerable situation and could have killed his pursuer, we read the following conversation. Then Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord the king." Then he said, "Why is my lord pursuing after his servant? For what have I done, and what evil is in my hand? And so then, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If Yahweh has incited you against me, may he delight in an offering. But if it is mortals, may they be accursed before Yahweh, for they have driven me away today from sharing in the inheritance of Yahweh, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" 1 Samuel 26:17-19. One of the points of David's distress is that he has been driven away from sharing in the inheritance of Yahweh. The inheritance language is the same as that found in Deuteronomy 32:8-9, where Jacob, Israel, is Yahweh's inheritance, the land and the people Yahweh took for himself. Is David ignorant of the fact that the God who made heaven and earth can be anywhere? No. In David's mind, being driven outside Israel meant not being able to worship Yahweh. Note that he does not complain of being driven from the Ark of the Covenant, located at Kiriath-Jearim, or from the Tabernacle, apparently located at Nob. His complaint is being expelled from the inheritance of Yahweh, the holy land of his God. David can't worship as he should if he's not on holy ground. The lands outside Israel belong to other gods. Naaman asks for dirt. Another fascinating story that illustrates the Israelite cosmic geographical worldview is the story of Naaman, the commander of the army of Syria, a foreign country just beyond Israel's northern border. Naaman also happened to be afflicted with leprosy. According to 2 Kings 5, at the suggestion of a captive Israelite servant girl, Naaman decides to seek the prophet Elisha for a cure for his condition. He travels to Israel, but Elisha doesn't even come out to talk to him in person. He sends a messenger to tell the military hero to wash himself in the Jordan 7 times if he wants to be healed. Insulted, Naaman at first resists, then relents at the encouragement of his servants. He does as instructed and emerges cleansed from the skin disease. Naaman returned to the prophet, who this time chose to speak with the Syrian. Picking up the story, "When he returned to the man of God, he and all of his army, he came and stood before him and said, 'Please, now I know that there is no God in all of the world except in Israel. So then please take a gift from your servant.' And he said, 'As Yahweh lives, before whom I stand, I surely will not take it.' Still he urged him to take it, but he refused. Then Naaman said, 'If not, then please let a load of soil on a pair of mules be given to your servants, for your servant will never again bring a burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but only to Yahweh. As far as this matter, may Yahweh pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he is leaning himself on my arm, that I also bow down in the house of Rimmon. When I bow down in the house of Rimmon, may Yahweh please pardon your servant in this matter.' He said to him, 'Go in peace.'" 2 Kings 5, 15-19. The brief trip into Israel and the encounter with Yahweh's prophet have taught Naaman some good theology. He affirms that there is no God in all the world except Israel. From henceforth, he will sacrifice only to Yahweh. But how can he keep that vow after returning to Syria? Simple. He pleads for dirt to take home. Naaman views the land of Israel as holy ground. It is Yahweh's territory. Naaman takes as much dirt as his mules can carry, so he can worship Yahweh on Yahweh's own territory, even though Naaman lives in the domain of the god Rimmon. We aren't told if Naaman went home and spread dirt on the floor of a room in his home. We don't know how he handled his duty to accompany his aged king into Rimmon's temple. Perhaps he carried dirt with him as a pledge of his believing loyalty to Yahweh. What we do know is that the dirt was a theological statement. Dirt from Israel was the means by which Naaman showed his faith and kept his vow to the true God, Yahweh. Daniel and Paul. Another passage in the Old Testament, Daniel 10, presumes the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. In Daniel 10, we read about a vision of the prophet. Daniel sees a man dressed in linen, whom he describes this way. Now his body was like turquoise, and his face was like the appearance of lightning, and his eyes were like torches of fire, and his arms and his legs were like the gleam of polished bronze, and the sound of his words was like the sound of a multitude. Daniel 10:6. We've seen before that shininess or brilliant luminescence is a stock description for a divine being. The radiant figure, who is never identified in the passage, says to Daniel, "You must not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I myself have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia stood before me for 21 days, and look, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to assist me, and I left him there beside the king of the Persians. And I have come to instruct you about what will happen to your people in the future, for there is a further vision here for the future." Verses 12 to 14. The figure later adds, before ending the conversation, "And now, I return to fight against the prince of Persia, and I myself am going, and look, the prince of Yavan will come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the Book of Truth, and there is not one who contends with me against these beings except Michael, your prince." Verses 20 and 21. Biblical scholars are in unanimous agreement that the princes referred to in Daniel 10 are divine beings, not humans. This is transparent from the mention of Michael in 10:13 and 10:21, who is called prince. They are also agreed that the concept is based on Deuteronomy 32:8-9. This passage, along with Deuteronomy 32:8-9, is the foundation for Paul's theology of the unseen world. This is made clear in an overarching sense in Acts 17:26-27, where Luke records Paul's speech at the Areopagus. In talking about God's salvation plan, Paul says, "And he, God, made from one man every nation of humanity to live on all the face of the earth, determining their fixed times and the fixed boundaries of their habitation, to search for God, if perhaps indeed they might feel around for him and find him, and indeed he is not far away from each one of us." Acts 17:26-27. Paul quite clearly alludes to the situation with the nations produced by God's judgment at Babel, the Deuteronomy 32:8-9 worldview. God had disinherited the nations as his people and made a new people for himself, Israel, his own portion. Immediately after the judgment at Babel, God called Abraham for that purpose, initiating a covenant relationship with Abraham and his yet unborn descendants. That covenant relationship included the idea Paul referred to in Acts 17:27, the drawing of the disinherited Gentile nations. Paul's rationale for his own ministry to the Gentiles was that it was God's intention to reclaim the nations to restore the original Edenic vision. Every person in every nation was given the opportunity to repent and believe in the risen Christ. Salvation was not only for the physical children of Abraham, but for anyone who would believe. More pointedly, Paul's terminology for the powers of darkness reflects the cosmic geographical worldview arising from Deuteronomy 32:8-9. The Hebrew word for prince, used throughout Daniel 10, is sar. In Daniel 10:13, where Michael is called one of the chief princes, the Septuagint refers to Michael as one of the chief archonton. Note: recall that the Septuagint is the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament. It was heavily used by the New Testament writers. Since the New Testament was composed in Greek, the majority of the quotations of the Old Testament by New Testament writers reflect the Septuagint, not the traditional Hebrew text. End note. In another Greek translation of Daniel, a text many scholars consider even older than the Septuagint currently in use, the Prince of Persia and Israel's prince, Michael, are both described with the Greek word archon. Note: see Theodotion's Greek text of Daniel. Michael is also called an archangel in Jude 9. The term refers to one who outranks other angels, in other words, has ruling authority over them. But Michael is not the only archangel. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 lacks the definite article before archangelio. That passage also distinguishes the term from the returning Jesus. In chapter 16 to 18, I discuss the evidence for the concept of a Godhead in the Old Testament, the evidence for two Yahweh figures in various passages who were interchangeable yet distinct. The second Yahweh is visible and embodied in human form. The most telling evidence is that of the angel of Yahweh, in whom resided the very presence of Yahweh, the name. The motifs associated with this second Yahweh in human form lay the groundwork for the incarnation of Yahweh as Jesus. I raise the issue of this content here because I do not consider Michael to be this second Yahweh figure. Briefly, I reject this equation for the following reasons. Michael is referred to as the Prince of Israel, and one of an unidentified number of chief princes. These statements must inform our reading of Daniel 8:11, where the little horn of Daniel's vision became great, even as great as the Prince of the Host. The phrase Prince of the Host transparently describes a leader of the entire heavenly host, in other words, all divine beings besides Yahweh. It is never used of Michael in the Bible. Daniel 8:11 leaves this figure unidentified. Consequently, linking Michael to this phrase is arbitrary. This fact is important in view of Daniel 8:25, where the earlier Prince of the Host is called the Prince of Princes. In Daniel 8, this figure, exalted above all divine beings under Yahweh, is assaulted by the little horn. Daniel 11:36 describes this same assault with slightly different language. There, the earthly king, who is the analogy to the little horn, shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. Since Daniel 8's Prince of the Host, who is Prince of Princes, is correlated with God of gods in Daniel 11:36, it would be coherent to see this unidentified figure as a second Yahweh figure who, as I describe in detail later, is identified with Jesus. In fact, in the Septuagint, the commander of Yahweh's army is described with archistrategos, a word that occurs as a synonym for archangelos in Second Temple Jewish literature. For example, Testament of Abraham, Long Recension, 1:4 and 14:10, Third Baruch, Greek Apocalypse, 11:8. I will argue in chapters 16 to 18 that this figure is the second embodied Yahweh, but none of this fits Michael. The phrases of Daniel 8 are never used of Michael, and so an identification of Michael with this figure, and therefore the God of gods and Jesus, lacks scriptural support. Michael is merely one of several chief princes. He is not exalted over all other princes. End note. These are the terms Paul uses when describing the rulers of this age, the rulers in heavenly places, and the ruler of the authority of the air. Paul often interchanged these terms with others that are familiar to most Bible students. Principalities, arche, powers and authorities, exousia, powers, dunamis, dominions, lords, kurios, thrones, thronos. These terms have something in common. They were used in both the New Testament and other Greek literature for geographical domain rulership. This is the divine dominion concept of Deuteronomy 32:8-9. At times, these terms are used of humans, but several instances demonstrate that Paul had spiritual beings in mind. The first three terms are found in Ephesians 6:12. Our struggle is not against blood and flesh, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Paul tells us in Ephesians 1:20-21 that when God raised Jesus from the dead, he seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion. It was only after Christ had risen that God's plan was made known to the rulers and the authorities in the heavenly places. These cosmic forces are the rulers and authorities disarmed and put to shame by the cross. The incident at Babel and God's decision to disinherit the nations drew up the battle lines for a cosmic turf war for the planet. The corruption of the Elohim, sons of God, set over the nations, meant that Yahweh's vision of a global Eden would be met with divine force. Every inch outside Israel would be contested, and Israel itself was fair game for hostile conquest. The gods would not surrender their inheritances back to Yahweh. He would have to reclaim them. God would take the first step in that campaign immediately after Babel. Section Summary. God's plan, that all the earth be Eden, came to a screeching halt almost as soon as it began. The Nahash arrogantly sought to be the Most High. His transgression succeeded in undermining the fulfillment of God's original intention for humanity, but failed to result in human destruction. The rebel inserted himself into the role of Most High, casting himself as God's mouthpiece, but wound up as Lord of the Dead. In some respects, the Nahash took humanity with him when Adam and Eve were barred from the presence of God and the Tree of Life, imagery that telegraphed the theological message that humans are mortal and that everlasting life in God's presence could come only through God's grace and mercy. Without saving grace, humanity was now the rightful property of death and its Lord. God, the life-giver, forgave Adam and Eve. They were not destroyed. Humanity would survive. They would bear children to perpetuate their line and, with it, keep God's original intention alive. The rule of God would someday return to earth, in His time, and by His methods. Evil would impede, but not defeat, God's purpose. This new circumstance, this gracious good news, would demand that humanity make the choice rejected in Eden. From this point forward, dwelling forever as a member of God's family council requires choosing loyalty to Him above any other divine voice. Free will rebellion didn't end with Eden. It was only the beginning for both divine and human imagers. Transgressions before and after the flood are cases in point, as well as points of reference. They set the stage for the rest of the Old Testament. Yahweh's portion would be Israel. He cast off the other nations and assigned them to lesser gods. Those gods became divine rivals, not servants of Yahweh. Their rule is corrupt. The rest of the Old Testament pits Yahweh against those gods and Israel against their nations. To make matters worse, the residue of Genesis 6 lived among the inhabitants of those nations, on the ground that Yahweh had promised to Abraham. Yahweh's chosen portion of land would be contested. War loomed. But first, Yahweh's portion, his people, would have to take root. Yahweh would initiate a relationship with Abraham, and that required a meeting. That presented a fundamental problem for God. He is so unlike anything in human experience that his pure presence cannot be processed by the human senses. It would, in fact, be lethal. God's solution was to veil himself for human protection and detection. This was necessary even in Eden, where the writer casts God as a man walking through the garden, searching for his fallen imagers. That, too, will emerge as a pattern hidden in plain sight. Part 4. Yahweh and His Portion. Chapter 16. Abraham's Word. We learned from Deuteronomy 32:8-9 that Yahweh placed the nations under the governance of junior Elohim, the sons of God of His divine counsel. Having disinherited humanity, unwilling as it was to fulfill the mandate of Eden to overspread the earth, he decided it was time to start over. The reader of Genesis gets the feeling that the new beginning was almost immediate, as the Tower of Babel story is immediately followed by the call of Abram. Abram was, of course, the original name of Abraham. God called this Mesopotamian man, seemingly out of the blue, to leave his extended family and journey to a foreign locale. God entered into a covenant with him, changed his name to Abraham, and then enabled him and his wife to produce a son, Isaac, in their advanced age. Isaac in turn became the father of Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel. Simple, right? It won't surprise you when I say there's much more going on than meets the eye. Abraham is about to meet his God, but for Abraham's protection, God must come to the man in a way that blunts the light of his own glory and helps Abraham process him as a person. The Joy of Abraham. We first encounter God's covenant promises to Abraham in Genesis 12. But that chapter isn't the beginning of God's dealing with Abraham. In Genesis 12, Abraham is not in Mesopotamia. He's in a place north of Canaan called Haran. To understand the real beginning of God's contact with Abraham, let's back up. After the Babel episode, the remainder of Genesis 11 is devoted to a genealogy. The genealogy of Abram, Abraham, back to Noah's son, Shem. Genealogies often contain something important or interesting, and this one is no exception. Compare the last two verses of Abraham's genealogical roots, Genesis 11:31-32, with Acts 7:2-4, and you'll discover that Yahweh first contacted Abraham before he got to Haran, and it was more than a conversation in his head. In Acts 7:2-4, Stephen says, "The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia, before he settled in Haran, and said to him, 'Go out from your land and from your relatives and come to the land that I will show you.' Then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. And from there, after his father died, he caused him to move to this land in which you now live." The important element to catch here is in the first line. Yahweh appeared to Abraham. Abraham's first divine encounter in Mesopotamia involved a visible appearance of Yahweh. Genesis 12 is a follow-up. Abraham and Yahweh had talked before, face to face. That's also what happened in Genesis 12. We're most familiar with the first three verses. "And Yahweh said to Abram, 'Go out from your land and from your relatives and from the house of your father to the land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you I will curse, and all families of the earth will be blessed in you.'" Genesis 12:1-3. But verses 6-7 deserve closer attention. "And Abram traveled through the land up to the place of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanites were in the land at the time, and Yahweh appeared to Abram and said, 'To your offspring I will give this land.' And he built an altar there to Yahweh, who had appeared to him." Verses 6-7. Twice in these two verses we read that Yahweh appeared to Abraham. A close reading of Genesis chapters 12 through 50 tells us that visible manifestation is the normal choice of Yahweh with respect to Abraham and his descendants, the patriarchs. This brings us to Genesis 15, 1-6, where the covenant of Genesis 12, 1-3 is repeated and ratified by a covenantal ceremony. The description of the person speaking to Abraham here is even more startling. After these things, the word of Yahweh came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, and your reward shall be very great." Then Abram said, "O Yahweh, my Lord, what will you give me? I continue to be childless, and my heir is Eliezer of Damascus." And Abram said, "Look, you have not given me a descendant, and here a member of my household is my heir." And behold, the word of Yahweh came to him, saying, "This person will not be your heir, but your own son will be your heir." And he brought him outside and said, "Look toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them." And he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." And he believed in Yahweh, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Genesis 15, 1-6. This is a fascinating text. Notice right from the start that it is the word of Yahweh who comes to Abraham in a vision. As before, the encounter was a visible manifestation of Yahweh. The word here is something that can be seen. Why else call it a vision? Note: our discussion of the word of the Lord here and elsewhere is not to suggest that every time this phrase occurs in the Bible, a visible figure is involved. In most cases, there is no suggestion in the context for that conclusion. At other times, such as the instances I'll highlight, the context drives that conclusion. The point, of course, is that this language, Yahweh is the visible word, even to the point of embodiment, is the conceptual backdrop for John's language about Jesus. End note. In verse 4, we read that the word brought him, Abraham, outside to continue the conversation. This isn't the kind of language one would expect if Abraham was hearing only a sound. These appearances of the word of Yahweh are the conceptual backdrop to the Apostle John's language in his gospel that Jesus was the Word. The most familiar instance is John 1:1. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And John 1:14, "And the Word became flesh, and took up residence among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the one and only from the Father, full of grace and truth." But John says some equally dramatic things in connection with this idea that are less familiar. In John 8:56, Jesus, the incarnate Word, informs his Jewish antagonists that he appeared to Abraham prior to his incarnation. "Abraham your father rejoiced that he would see my day, and he saw it and was glad." The Jews object vehemently to this claim, whereupon Jesus utters his famous statement, "Before Abraham was, I am." John 8:58. Only Genesis 12 and 15 provide the coherent backdrop to this claim. I hope you grasp the significance of the interchange. Since the word is clearly equated with and identified as Yahweh in Genesis 12 and 15, when the New Testament has Jesus saying, "That was me," he is claiming to be the Word of the Old Testament, who was the visible Yahweh. This understanding is also behind some of the things Paul says about Abraham and Jesus. In Galatians 3:8, Paul says that the gospel, that God would justify the Gentile nations, was preached to Abraham. This is a clear reference to the content of the Abrahamic covenant, delivered personally and visibly by the Word. Yahweh visible and embodied. The fact that the Old Testament at times has Yahweh appearing in visible form should now be on your radar. We're going to see a lot more of him, pun intended. One of my favorite passages that features Yahweh made visible is 1 Samuel 3. the story of the young soon-to-be prophet Samuel. Many readers will no doubt be familiar with it. The chapter opens with the cryptic statement, "The word of Yahweh was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread."